narrow trickle, and Shanice's finger silently followed it down to where it straggled to a halt, and then, as his finger continued moving onward, to a spot where one single star sparked lonesomely. And there his finger halted, for beyond that was blackness, unrelieved. "Stars end," said the young man, simply. "The fabric of the nebula is thin there, and the light of that one star finds its way through in just that one direction, to shine on Trantor."
"You're trying to tell me that..." The voice of the mule's general died in suspicion.
"I'm not trying. That is Tazenda. Stars end." The lights went on. The lens flicked off. Pritchard reached Shanice in three long strides. "What made you think of this?" And Shanice leaned back in his chair with a queerly puzzled expression on his face.
"It was accidental. I'd like to take intellectual credit for this, but it was only accidental. In any case, however it happens, it fits. According to our references, Tazenda is an oligarchy. It rules 27 inhabited planets. It is not advanced scientifically, and most of all, it is an obscure world that has adhered to a strict neutrality in the local politics of that stellar region and is not expansionist. I think we ought to see it."
"Have you informed the mule of this?"
"No. Nor shall we. We're in space now, about to make the first hop."
Pritchard, in sudden horror, sprang to the visiplate. Cold space met his eyes when he adjusted it. He gazed fixedly at the view, then turned. Automatically, his hand reached for the hard, comfortable curve of the butt of his blaster. "By whose order?"
"By my order, General." It was the first time Shanice had ever used the other's title. "While I was engaging you here, you probably felt no acceleration because it came at the moment I was expanding the field of the lens, and you undoubtedly imagined it to be an illusion of the apparent star motion."
"Why? Just what are you doing? What was the point of your nonsense about Tazenda, then?"
"That was no nonsense. I was completely serious. We're going there. We left today because we were scheduled to leave 3 days from now."
"General, you don't believe there is a second foundation, and I do. You are merely following the mule's orders without faith. I recognize a serious danger. The second foundation has now had 5 years to prepare. How they've prepared, I don't know. But what if they have agents on Calgan? If I carry about in my mind the knowledge of the whereabouts of the second foundation, they may discover that. My life might be no longer safe, and I have a great affection for my life. Even on a thin and remote possibility such as that, I would rather play safe. So no one knows of Tazenda but you, and you found out only after we were out in space. And even so, there is the question of the crew." Shanice was smiling again, ironically, in obviously complete control of the situation. Pritchard's hand fell away from his blaster, and for a moment, a vague discomfort pierced him. What kept him from action? What deadened him? There was a time when he was a rebellious and unpromoted captain of the First Foundation's commercial empire, when it would have been himself rather than Shanice who would have taken prompt and daring action such as that. Was the mule right? Was his controlled mind so concerned with obedience as to lose initiative? He felt a thickening despondency drive him down into a strange lassitude. He said, "Well done. However, you will consult me in the future before making decisions of this nature."
The flickering signal caught his attention. "That's the engine room," said Shanice casually. "They warmed up on 5 minutes' notice, and I asked them to let me know if there was any trouble. Want to hold the fort?"
Pritchard nodded mutely and cogitated in the sudden loneliness on the evils of approaching 50. The visiplate was sparsely starred. The main body of the galaxy misted one end. What if he were free of the mule's influence? But he recoiled in horror at the thought.
Chief Engineer Huxlane looked sharply at the young, ununiformed man who carried himself with the assurance of a fleet officer and seemed to be in a position of authority. Huxlane, as a regular fleet man from the days his chin had dripped milk, generally confused authority with specific insignia. But the mule had appointed this man, and the mule was, of course, the last word. The only word, for that matter. Not even subconsciously did he question that. Emotional control went deep. He handed Chanice the little oval object without a word. Chanice hefted it and smiled engagingly.
"You're a Foundation man, aren't you, Chief?"
"Yes, sir. I served in the Foundation fleet 18 years before the First Citizen took over."
"Foundation training in engineering?"
"Qualified technician first class. Central school on Anacreon."
"Good enough. And you found this on the communication circuit where I asked you to look?"
"Yes, sir."
"Does it belong there?"
"No, sir."
"Then what is it?"
"A hyper relay, sir."
"That's not enough. I'm not a Foundation man. What is it?"
"It's a device to allow the ship to be traced through hyperspace."
"In other words, we can be followed anywhere."
"Yes, sir."
"All right. This version is a recent improvement, isn't it? It was developed by one of the research institutes set up by the First Citizen, wasn't it?"
"I believe so, sir."
"And its workings are a government secret, right?"
"I believe so, sir."
"Yet here it is. Intriguing."
Chanice tossed the hyper-relay methodically from hand to hand for a few seconds. Then sharply, he held it out.
"Take it, then, and put it back exactly where you found it and exactly how you found it. Understand? And then forget this incident. Entirely."
The chief choked down his near-automatic salute, turned sharply, and left. The ship bounded through the galaxy, its path a wide-spaced dotted line through the stars. The dots referred to were the scant stretches of 10 to 60 light seconds spent in normal space, and between them stretched gaps of many parsecs that represented the jumps through hyperspace. Bail Chanice sat at the control panel of the lens and felt again the involuntary surge of near worship at the contemplation of it. He was not a Foundation man, and the interplay of forces at the twist of a knob or the breaking of a contact was not second nature to him. Not that the lens ought quite to bore even a Foundation man. Within its unbelievably compact body were enough electronic circuits to pinpoint accurately 100 million separate stars in exact relationship to each other. And as if that were not a feat in itself, it was further capable of translating any given portion of the galactic field along any of the 3 spatial axes, or of rotating any portion of the field about a center. It was because of that that the lens had performed a near revolution in interstellar travel. In the younger days of interstellar travel, the calculation of each jump through hyperspace meant any amount of work from a day to a week, and the larger portion of such work was the more or less precise calculation of ship's position on the galactic scale of reference. Essentially, that meant the accurate observation of at least three widely spaced stars, the positions of which, with reference to the arbitrary galactic triple zero, were known. And it is the word known that is the catch. To any who know the star field well from one certain reference point, stars are as individual as people. Jump 10 parsecs, however, and not even your own sun is recognizable. It may not even be visible. The answer was, of course, spectroscopic analysis. For centuries, the main object of interstellar engineering was the analysis of the light signature of more and more stars in greater and greater detail. With this, and the growing precision of the jump itself, standard routes of travel through the galaxy were adopted, and interstellar travel became less of an art and more of a science. And yet, even under the Foundation, with improved computers and a new method of mechanically scanning the star field for a known light signature, it sometimes took days to locate 3 stars and then calculate position in regions not previously familiar to the pilot. It was the lens that changed all that. For one thing, it required only a single known star. For another, even a space tyro such as Janus could operate it. The nearest sizable star at the moment was Vincitori, according to jump calculations, and on the visiplate now, a bright star was centered. Janus hoped that it was Vincitori. The field screen of the lens was thrown directly next to that of the visiplate, and with careful fingers, Janus punched out the coordinates of Vincitori. He closed a relay, and the star field sprang to bright view. In it, too, a bright star was centered, but otherwise there seemed no relationship. He adjusted the lens along the Z-axis and expanded the field to where the photometer showed both centered stars to be of equal brightness. Janus looked for a second star, sizably bright on the visiplate, and found one on the field screen to correspond. Slowly he rotated the screen to similar angular deflection. He twisted his mouth and rejected the result with a grimace. Again he rotated, and another bright star was brought into position, and a third. And then he grinned. That did it. Perhaps a specialist with trained relationship perception might have clicked first try, but he'd settle for 3. That was the adjustment. In the final step, the 2 fields overlapped and merged into a sea of not quite rightness. Most of the stars were close doubles, but the fine adjustment did not take long. The double stars melted together, 1 field remained, and the ship's position could now be read directly off the dials. The entire procedure had taken less than 30 minutes. Janus found Han Pritcher in his private quarters. The general was quite apparently preparing for bed. He looked up. News? Not particularly. We'll be at Tzenda in another hop. I know. I don't want to bother you if you're turning in, but have you looked through the film we picked up in Sill? Han Pritcher cast a disparaging look at the article in question, where it lay in its black case upon his low bookshelf. Yes. And what do you think? I think that if there was ever any science to history, it has been quite lost in this region of the galaxy. Janus grinned broadly. I know what you mean. Rather barren, isn't it? Not if you enjoy personal chronicles of rulers. Probably unreliable, I should say, in both directions. Where history concerns mainly personalities, the drawings become either black or white according to the interests of the writer. I find it all remarkably useless. But there is talk about Tzenda. That's the point I tried to make when I gave you the film. It's the only one I could find that even mentioned them. All right. They have good rulers and bad. They've conquered a few planets, won some battles, lost a few. There is nothing distinctive about them. I don't think much of your theory, Janus. but you've missed a few points. Didn't you notice that they never formed coalitions? They always remained completely outside the politics of this corner of the star swarm. As you say, they conquered a few planets, but then they stopped. And that without any startling defeat of consequence. It's just as if they spread out enough to protect themselves, but not enough to attract attention. Very well, came the unemotional response. I have no objection to landing. At the worst, a little lost time. Oh, no. At the worst, complete defeat. If it is the Second Foundation. Remember, it would be a world of space knows how many mules. What do you plan to do? Land on some minor subject planet. Find out as much as we can about Tazenda first, then improvise from that. All right. No objection. If you don't mind now, I would like the light out. Chanis left with a wave of his hand. And in the darkness of a tiny room in an island of driving metal lost in the vastness of space, General Han Pritcher remained awake, following the thoughts that led him through such fantastic reaches. If everything he had so painfully decided were true, and how all the facts were beginning to fit, then Tazenda was the Second Foundation. There was no way out. But how? How? Could it be Tazenda? An ordinary world? One without distinction? A slum lost amid the wreckage of an empire? A splinter among the fragments? He remembered as from a distance the mule's shriveled face and his thin voice as he used to speak of the old Foundation psychologist Ebling Meese, the one man who had, maybe, learned the secret of the Second Foundation. Pritcher recalled the tension of the mule's words. It was as if astonishment had overwhelmed Meese. It was as though something about the Second Foundation had surpassed all his expectations, had driven in a direction completely different from what he might have assumed. If I could only have read his thoughts rather than his emotions. Yet the emotions were plain, and above everything else was this vast surprise. Surprise was the keynote. Something supremely astonishing. And now came this boy, this grinning youngster, glibly joyful about Tazenda and its undistinguished subnormality. And he had to be right. He had to. Otherwise, nothing made sense. Pritcher's last conscious thought had a touch of grimness. That hypertracer along the etheric tube was still there. He had checked it 1 hour back, with Chanis well out of the way. Second Interlude. It was a casual meeting in the anteroom of the council chamber. Just a few moments before passing into the chamber to take up the business of the day, and the few thoughts flashed back and forth quickly. So the mule is on his way. That's what I hear, too. Risky. Mighty risky. Not if affairs adhere to the functions set up. The mule is not an ordinary man, and it is difficult to manipulate his chosen instruments without detection by him. The controlled minds are difficult to touch. They say he's caught on to a few cases. Yes, I don't see how that can be avoided. Uncontrolled minds are easier. But so few are in positions of authority under him. They entered the chamber. Others of the Second Foundation followed them. Chapter 3. Two Men and a Peasant. Rossum is one of those marginal worlds usually neglected in galactic history, and scarcely ever obtruding itself upon the notice of men of the myriad happier planets. In the latter days of the Galactic Empire, a few political prisoners had inhabited its wastes, while an observatory and a small naval garrison served to keep it from complete desertion. Later, in the evil days of strife, even before the time of Harry Seldon, the weaker sort of men, tired of the periodic decades of insecurity and danger, weary of sacked planets and a ghostly succession of ephemeral emperors making their way to the purple for a few wicked, fruitless years, these men fled the populated centers and sought shelter in the barren nooks of the galaxy. Along the chilly wastes of Rossum, villages huddled. Its sun was a small, ruddy niggard that clutched its dribble of heat to itself, while snow beat thinly down for 9 months of the year. The tough native grain lay dormant in the soil those snow-filled months, then grew and ripened in almost panic speed when the sun's reluctant radiation brought the temperature to nearly 50. Small, goat-like animals cropped the grasslands, kicking the thin snow aside with tiny, tri-hooved feet. The men of Rossum had thus their bread and their milk, and when they could spare an animal, even their meat. The darkly ominous forests that gnarled their way over half of the equatorial region of the planet supplied a tough, fine-grained wood for housing. This wood, together with certain furs and minerals, was even worth exporting, and the ships of the Empire came at times and brought in exchange farm machinery, nuclear heaters, even television sets. The last was not really incongruous, for the long winter imposed a lonely hibernation upon the peasant. Imperial history flowed past the peasants of Rossum. The trading ships might bring news in impatient spurts. Occasionally new fugitives would arrive. At one time, a relatively large group arrived in a body and remained, and these usually had news of the galaxy. It was then that the Rossumites learned of sweeping battles and decimated populations, or of tyrannical emperors and rebellious viceroys. And they would sigh and shake their heads and draw their fur collars closer about their bearded faces as they sat about the village square in the weak sun and philosophized on the evil of men. Then after a while, no trading ships arrived at all, and life grew harder. Supplies of foreign, soft food, of tobacco, of machinery, stopped. Vague word from scraps gathered on the hyperbands of their television sets brought increasingly disturbing news. And finally it spread that Trantor had been sacked. The great capital world of all the galaxy, the splendid, storied, unapproachable, and incomparable home of the emperors, had been despoiled and ruined and brought to utter destruction. It was something inconceivable, and to many of the peasants of Rossum, scratching away at their fields, it might well seem that the end of the galaxy was at hand. And then one day, not unlike other days, a ship arrived again. The old men of each village nodded wisely and lifted their old eyelids to whisper that thus it had been in their father's time. But it wasn't quite. This ship was not an imperial ship. The glowing spaceship and sun of the Empire was missing from its prow. It was a stubby affair made of scraps of older ships, and the men within called themselves soldiers of Tazenda. The peasants were confused. They had not heard of Tazenda, but they greeted the soldiers nevertheless in the traditional fashion of hospitality. The newcomers inquired closely as to the nature of the planet, the number of its inhabitants, the number of its cities, a word mistaken by the peasants to mean villages, to the confusion of all concerned, its type of economy, and so on. Other ships came, and proclamations were issued all over the world that Tazenda was now the ruling world, that tax-collecting stations would be established girdling the equator, the inhabited region, that percentages of grain and furs, according to certain numerical formulae, would be collected annually. The Rossumites had blinked solemnly, uncertain of the word taxes. When collection time came, many had paid, or had stood by in confusion while the uniformed other worldlings loaded the harvested corn and the pelts onto the broad ground cars. Here and there, indignant peasants banded together and brought out ancient hunting weapons. But of this nothing ever came. Grumblingly, they had disbanded when the men of Tazenda came and, with dismay, watched their hard struggle for existence become harder. But a new equilibrium was reached. The Tazendian governor lived dourly in the village of Gentry, from which all Rossumites were barred. He and the officials under him were dim, otherworld beings that rarely impinged on the Rossumite ken. The tax farmers, Rossumites, in the employ of Tazenda, came periodically, but they were creatures of custom now. And the peasant had learned how to hide his grain and drive his cattle into the forest and refrain from having his hut appear too ostentatiously prosperous. Then with a dull, uncomprehending expression, he would greet all sharp questioning as to his assets by merely pointing at what they could see. Even that grew less, and taxes decreased, almost as if Tazenda wearied of extorting pennies from such a world. Trading sprang up, and perhaps Tazenda found that more profitable. The men of Rossum no longer received in exchange the polished creations of the empire, but even Tazendian machines and Tazendian food was better than the native stuff. And there were clothes for the women of other than gray homespun, which was a very important thing. So once again, galactic history glided past peacefully enough, and the peasants scrabbled life out of the hard soil. Nairovi blew into his beard as he stepped out of his cottage. The first snows were sifting across the hard ground, and the sky was a dull, overcast pink. He squinted carefully upward and decided that no real storm was in sight. He could travel to Gentry without much trouble and get rid of his surplus grain in return for enough canned foods to last the winter. He roared back through the door, which he opened a crack for the purpose. "Has the carbon fed its fuel, Junker?" A voice shouted from within, and then Nairovi's oldest son, his short, red beard not yet completely outgrown its boyish sparseness, joined him. "The car," he said sullenly, "is fueled and rides well, but for the bad condition of the axles. For that I am of no blame. I have told you it needs expert repairs." The old man stepped back and surveyed his son through lowering eyebrows, then thrust his hairy chin outward. "And is the fault mine? Where and in what manner may I achieve expert repairs? Has the harvest, then, been anything but scanty for 5 years? Have my herds escaped the pest? Have the pelts climbed of themselves? Nairovi!" The well-known voice from within stopped him in mid-word. He grumbled, "Well, well. And now your mother must insert herself into the affairs of a father and his son. Bring out the car, and see to it that the storage trailers are securely attached." He pounded his gloved hands together and looked upward again. The dimly ruddy clouds were gathering, and the gray sky that showed in the rifts bore no warmth. The sun was hidden. He was at the point of looking away when his dropping eyes caught, and his finger almost automatically rose on high, while his mouth fell open in a shout, in complete disregard of the cold air. "Wife," he called vigorously. "Old woman, come here." An indignant head appeared at a window. The woman's eyes followed his finger, gaped. With a cry, she dashed down the wooden stairs, snatching up an old wrap and a square of linen as she went. She emerged with the linen wrapped insecurely over her head and ears, and the wrap dangling from her shoulders. She snuffled. "It is a ship from outer space." And Nairovi remarked impatiently, And what else could it be? We have visitors, old woman, visitors. The ship was sinking slowly to a landing on the bare, frozen field in the northern portions of Nairobi's farm.
But what shall we do? Gasped the woman. Can we offer these people hospitality? Is the dirt floor of our hovel to be theirs and the pickings of last week's hoe cake?
Shall they then go to our neighbors? Nairobi purpled past the crimson induced by the cold, and his arms in their sleek fur covering lunged out and seized the woman's brawny shoulders. Wife of my soul, he purred, you will take the two chairs from our room downstairs. You will see that a fat youngling is slaughtered and roasted with tubers. You will bake a fresh hoe cake. I go now to greet these men of power from outer space. And he paused, placed his great cap awry, and scratched hesitantly. Yes, I shall bring my jug of brewed grain as well. Hearty drink is pleasant. The woman's mouth had flapped idly during this speech. Nothing came out. And when that stage passed, it was only a discordant screech that issued. Nairobi lifted a finger. Old woman, what was it the village elders said, a Senite sense? Eh? Stir your memory. The elders went from farm to farm. Themselves. Imagine the importance of it. To ask us that should any ships from outer space land, they were to be informed immediately on the orders of the governor. And now shall I not seize the opportunity to win into the good graces of those in power? Regard that ship. Have you ever seen its like? These men from the outer worlds are rich, great. The governor himself sends such urgent messages concerning them that the elders walk from farm to farm in the cooling weather. Perhaps the message is sent throughout all Rossum that these men are greatly desired by the lords of Tazenda. And it is on my farm that they are landing. He fairly hopped for anxiety. The proper hospitality now. The mention of my name to the governor? And what may not be ours? His wife was suddenly aware of the cold biting through her thin house clothing. She leaped toward the door, shouting over her shoulder, "Leave then, quickly!" But she was speaking to a man who was even then racing toward the segment of the horizon against which the ship sank. Neither the cold of the world nor its bleak, empty spaces worried General Han Pritcher, nor the poverty of their surroundings, nor the perspiring peasant himself. What did bother him was the question of the wisdom of their tactics. He and Shanice were alone here. The ship, left in space, could take care of itself in ordinary circumstances, but still, he felt unsafe. It was Chanis, of course, who was responsible for this move. He looked across at the young man and caught him winking cheerfully at the gap in the furred partition, in which a woman's peeping eyes and gaping mouth momentarily appeared. Chanis, at least, seemed completely at ease. That fact Pritcher savored with a vinegary satisfaction. His game had not much longer to proceed exactly as he wished it. Yet meanwhile their wrist sets were their only connection with the ship. And then the peasant host smiled enormously and bobbed his head several times and said in a voice oily with respect, "Noble lords, I crave leave to tell you that my eldest son, a good, worthy lad whom my poverty prevents from educating as his wisdom deserves, has informed me that the elders will arrive soon. I trust your stay here has been as pleasant as my humble means, for I am poverty-stricken, though a hard-working, honest and humble farmer, as anyone here will tell you, could afford.
Elders, said Shannis lightly.
The chief men of the region here.
So they are, noble lords, and honest, worthy men, all of them, for our entire village is known throughout Rossum as a just and righteous spot. Though living is hard, and the returns of the fields and forests meager. Perhaps you will mention to the elders, noble lords, of my respect and honor for travelers, and it may happen that they will request a new motor wagon for our household, as the old one can scarcely creep, and upon the remnant of it depends our livelihood.
He looked humbly eager, and Han Pritchard nodded with the properly aloof condescension required of the role of noble lords bestowed upon them.
A report of your hospitality shall reach the ears of your elders.
Pritchard seized the next moments of isolation to speak to the apparently half-sleeping Channis.
I am not particularly fond of this meeting of the elders, he said. Have you any thoughts on the subject?
Channis seemed surprised.
No? What worries you?
It seems we have better things to do than to become conspicuous here.
Channis spoke hastily in a low, monotoned voice. It may be necessary to risk becoming conspicuous in our next moves. We won't find the type of men we want, Pritchard, by simply reaching out a hand into a dark bag and groping. Men who rule by tricks of the mind need not necessarily be men in obvious power. In the first place, the psychologists of the Second Foundation are probably a very small minority of the total population. Just as on your own First Foundation, the technicians and scientists formed a minority. The ordinary inhabitants are probably just that, very ordinary. The psychologists may even be well hidden, and the men in the apparently ruling position may honestly think they are the true masters. Our solution to that problem may be found here, on this frozen lump of a planet.
I don't follow that at all.
Why, see here, it's obvious enough. Tazenda is probably a huge world of millions, or hundreds of millions. How could we identify the psychologists among them and be able to report truly to the mule that we have located the Second Foundation? But here, on this tiny peasant world and subject planet, all the Tazendian rulers, our host informs us, are concentrated in their chief village of Gentry. There may be only a few hundred of them there, Pritchard, and among them must be one or more of the men of the Second Foundation. We will go there eventually, but let us see the elders first. It's a logical step on the way.
They drew apart easily as their black-bearded host tumbled into the room again, obviously agitated.
Noble lords, the elders are arriving. I crave leave to beg you once more to mention a word, perhaps on my behalf.
He almost bent double in a paroxysm of fawning.
We shall certainly remember you, said Channis.
Are these your elders?
They apparently were.
There were three.
One approached. He bowed with a dignified respect and said, "We are honored. Transportation has been provided, respected sirs, and we hope for the pleasure of your company at our meeting hall."
Third interlude. The first speaker gazed wistfully at the night sky. Wispy clouds scudded across the star gleams. Space looked actively hostile. It was cold and awful at best, but now it contained that strange creature, the mule, and the very content seemed to darken and thicken it into ominous threat. The meeting was over. It had not been long. There had been the doubts and questionings inspired by the difficult mathematical problem of dealing with a mental mutant of uncertain makeup. All the extreme permutations had to be considered. Were they even yet certain? Somewhere in this region of space, within reaching distance as galactic spaces go, was the mule. What would he do? It was easy enough to handle his men. They reacted and were reacting according to plan. But what of the mule himself? Chapter 4. Two Men and the Elders. The elders of this particular region of Rossum were not exactly what one might have expected. They were not a mere extrapolation of the peasantry. Older, more authoritative, less friendly? Not at all. The dignity that had marked them at first meeting had grown in impression till it had reached the mark of being their predominant characteristic. They sat about their oval table like so many grave and slow-moving thinkers. Most were a trifle past their physical prime, though the few who possessed beards wore them short and neatly arranged. Still, enough appeared younger than 40 to make it quite obvious that elders was a term of respect rather than entirely a literal description of age. The two from outer space were at the head of the table, and in the solemn silence that accompanied a rather frugal meal that seemed ceremonious rather than nourishing, absorbed the new, contrasting atmosphere. After the meal and after one or two respectful remarks, too short and simple to be called speeches, had been made by those of the elders apparently held most in esteem, an informality forced itself upon the assembly. It was as if the dignity of greeting foreign personages had finally given way to the amiable rustic qualities of curiosity and friendliness. They crowded around the two strangers and the flood of questions came. They asked if it were difficult to handle a spaceship, how many men were required for the job, if better motors could be made for their ground cars, if it was true that it rarely snowed on other worlds, as was said to be the case with Tazenda, how many people lived on their world, if it was as large as Tazenda, if it was far away, how their clothes were woven, and what gave them the metallic shimmer, why they did not wear furs, if they shaved every day, what sort of stone that was in Pritchard's ring. The list stretched out. And almost always the questions were addressed to Pritchard, as though, as the elder, they automatically invested him with the greater authority. Pritchard found himself forced to answer at greater and greater length. It was like an immersion in a crowd of children. Their questions were those of utter and disarming wonder. Their eagerness to know was completely irresistible and would not be denied. Pritchard explained that spaceships were not difficult to handle and that crews varied with the size from one to many, that the motors of their ground cars were unknown in detail to him but could doubtless be improved, that the climates of worlds varied almost infinitely, that many hundreds of millions lived on his world but that it was far smaller and more insignificant than the great empire of Tazenda, that their clothes were woven of silicone plastics in which metallic luster was artificially produced by proper orientation of the surface molecules, and that they could be artificially heated so that furs were unnecessary, that they shaved every day, that the stone in his ring was an amethyst. The list stretched out. He found himself thawing to these naive provincials against his will. And always, as he answered, there was a rapid chatter among the elders, as though they debated the information gained. It was difficult to follow these inner discussions of theirs, for they lapsed into their own accented version of the universal galactic language that, through long separation from the currents of living speech, had become archaic. Almost, one might say, their curt comments among themselves hovered on the edge of understanding, but just managed to elude the clutching tendrils of comprehension. until finally Channis interrupted to say, "Good sirs, you must answer us for a while, for we are strangers and would be very much interested to know all we can of Tazenda." And what happened then was that a great silence fell, and each of the hitherto voluble elders grew silent. Their hands, which had been moving in such rapid and delicate accompaniment to their words, as though to give them greater scope and varied shades of meaning, fell suddenly limp. They stared furtively at one another, apparently quite willing each to let the other have all the floor. Pritcher interposed quickly, "My companion asks this in friendliness, for the fame of Tazenda fills the galaxy, and we, of course, shall inform the governor of the loyalty and love of the elders of Rossum." No sigh of relief was heard, but faces brightened. An elder stroked his beard with thumb and forefinger, straightening its slight curl with a gentle pressure, and said, "We are faithful servants of the lords of Tazenda." Pritchard's annoyance at Channis's bald question subsided. It was apparent, at least, that the age that he had felt creeping over him of late had not yet deprived him of his own capacity for making smooth the blunders of others. He continued, "We do not know in our far part of the universe much of the past history of the lords of Tazenda. We presume they have ruled benevolently here for a long time." The same elder who spoke before answered. In a soft, automatic way, he had become spokesman. He said, "Not the grandfather of the oldest can recall a time in which the lords were absent."
"It has been a time of peace."
"It has been a time of peace." He hesitated. "The governor is a strong and powerful lord who would not hesitate to punish traitors. None of us are traitors, of course."
"He has punished some in the past, I imagine, as they deserve."
Again, hesitation. "None here have ever been traitors, or our fathers, or our fathers' fathers.
But on other worlds, there have been such, and death followed for them quickly.
It is not good to think of, for we are humble men who are poor farmers and not concerned with matters of politics."
The anxiety in his voice, the universal concern in the eyes of all of them, was obvious.
Pritcher said smoothly, "Could you inform us as to how we can arrange an audience with your governor?" And instantly an element of sudden bewilderment entered the situation. For after a long moment the elder said, "Why, did you not know? The governor will be here tomorrow. He has expected you. It has been a great honor for us. We hope earnestly that you will report to him satisfactorily as to our loyalty to him." Pritchard's smile scarcely twitched. "Expected us?" The elder looked wonderingly from one to the other. "Why, it is now a week since we have been waiting for you." Their quarters were undoubtedly luxurious for the world. Pritchard had lived in worse. Channis showed nothing but indifference to externals. But there was an element of tension between them of a different nature than hitherto. Pritchard felt the time approaching for a definite decision, and yet there was still the desirability of additional waiting. To see the governor first would be to increase the gamble to dangerous dimensions, and yet to win that gamble might multi-double the winnings. He felt a surge of anger at the slight crease between Channis's eyebrows, the delicate uncertainty with which the young man's lower lip presented itself to an upper tooth. He detested the useless play-acting and yearned for an end to it. He said, "We seem to be anticipated." "Yes," said Channis, simply. Just that? You have no contribution of greater pith to make. We come here and find that the governor expects us. Presumably we shall find from the governor that Tazenda itself expects us. Of what value, then, is our entire mission? Chanis looked up without endeavoring to conceal the weary note in his voice. To expect us is one thing. To know who we are and what we came for is another. Do you expect to conceal these things from men of the Second Foundation? Perhaps. Why not? Are you ready to throw your hand in? Suppose our ship was detected in space. Is it unusual for a realm to maintain frontier observation posts? Even if we were ordinary strangers, we would be of interest. Sufficient interest for a governor to come to us rather than the reverse? Chanis shrugged. We'll have to meet that problem later. Let us see what this governor is like. Pritchard bared his teeth in a bloodless kind of scowl. The situation was becoming ridiculous. Chanis proceeded with an artificial animation. At least we know one thing. Tazenda is the Second Foundation, or a million shreds of evidence are unanimously pointing the wrong way. How do you interpret the obvious terror in which these natives hold Tazenda? I see no signs of political domination. Their groups of elders apparently meet freely and without interference of any sort. The taxation they speak of doesn't seem at all extensive to me or efficiently carried through. The natives speak much of poverty but seem sturdy and well-fed. The houses are uncouth and their villages rude, but are obviously adequate for the purpose. In fact, the world fascinates me. I have never seen a more forbidding one, yet I am convinced there is no suffering among the population, and that their uncomplicated lives manage to contain a well-balanced happiness, lacking in the sophisticated populations of the advanced centers. Are you an admirer of peasant virtues, then? The stars forbid. Chanis seemed amused at the idea. I merely point out the significance of all this. Apparently, Tazenda is an efficient administrator. Efficient in a sense far different from the efficiency of the old empire, or of the First Foundation, or even of our own union. All these have brought mechanical efficiency to their subjects at the cost of more intangible values. Tazenda brings happiness and sufficiency. Don't you see that the whole orientation of their domination is different? It is not physical, but psychological. Really? Pritchard allowed himself irony. And the terror with which the elders spoke of the punishment of treason by these kind-hearted psychologist administrators? How does that suit your thesis? Were they the objects of the punishment? They speak of punishment only of others. It is as if knowledge of punishment has been so well implanted in them that punishment itself need never be used. The proper mental attitudes are so inserted into their minds that I am certain that not a Tazendian soldier exists on the planet. Don't you see all this? I'll see, perhaps, said Pritchard coldly, when I see the governor. And what, by the way, if our mentalities are handled? Chanis replied with brutal contempt, You should be accustomed to that. Pritchard whitened perceptibly, and with an effort turned away. They spoke to one another no more that day. It was in the silent windlessness of the frigid night, as he listened to the soft, sleeping motions of the other, that Pritchard silently adjusted his wrist transmitter to the ultra-wave region for which Chanis's was unadjustable, and, with noiseless touches of his fingernail, contacted the ship. The answer came in little periods of noiseless vibration that barely lifted themselves above the sensory threshold. Twice, Pritchard asked, "Any communications at all yet?" Twice the answer came, "None. We wait always." He got out of bed. It was cold in the room, and he pulled the furry blanket around him as he sat in the chair and stared out at the crowding stars, so different in the brightness and complexity of their arrangement from the even fog of the galactic lens that dominated the night sky of his native periphery. Somewhere there, between the stars, was the answer to the complications that overwhelmed him, and he felt the yearning for that solution to arrive and end things. For a moment he wondered again if the mule were right, if conversion had robbed him of the firm, sharp edge of self-reliance. Or was it simply age and the fluctuations of these last years? He didn't really care. He was tired. The governor of Rossum arrived with minor ostentation. His only companion was the uniformed man at the controls of the ground car. The ground car itself was of lush design, but to Pritchard it appeared inefficient. It turned clumsily. More than once it apparently balked at what might have been a too rapid change of gears. It was obvious at once from its design that it ran on chemical and not on nuclear fuel. The Tazendian governor stepped softly onto the thin layer of snow and advanced between two lines of respectful elders. He did not look at them, but entered quickly. They followed after him. From the quarters assigned to them, the two men of the Mule's Union watched. He, the governor, was thick-set, rather stocky, short, unimpressive. But what of that? Pritchard cursed himself for a failure of nerve. His face, to be sure, remained icily calm. There was no humiliation before Channis, but he knew very well that his blood pressure had heightened and his throat had become dry. It was not a case of physical fear. He was not one of those dull-witted, unimaginative men of nerveless meat who were too stupid ever to be afraid. But physical fear he could account for and discount. But this was different. It was the other fear. He glanced quickly at Channis. The young man glanced idly at the nails of one hand and poked leisurely at some trifling unevenness. Something inside Pritchard became vastly indignant. What had Channis to fear of mental handling? Pritchard caught a mental breath and tried to think back. How had he been before the mule had converted him from the die-hard Democrat that he had been? It was hard to remember. He could not place himself mentally. He could not break the clinging wires that bound him emotionally to the mule. Intellectually, he could remember that he had once tried to assassinate the mule, but not for all the straining he could endure could he remember his emotions at the time. That might be the self-defense of his own mind, however, for at the intuitive thought of what those emotions might have been, not realizing the details but merely comprehending the drift of it, his stomach grew queasy. What if the governor tampered with his mind? What if the insubstantial mental tendrils of a second foundationer insinuated itself down the emotional crevices of his makeup and pulled them apart and rejoined them? There had been no sensation the first time. There had been no pain, no mental jar, not even a feeling of discontinuity. He had always loved the mule. If there had ever been a time long before as 5 short years, when he had thought he hadn't loved him, that he had hated him, that was just a horrid illusion. The thought of that illusion embarrassed him. But there had been no pain. Would meeting the governor duplicate that? Would all that had gone before, all his service for the mule, all his life's orientation, join the hazy, other-life dream that held the word democracy? The mule also a dream, and only